Standing midway. Today is December 18th?
16th.
Yeah, I think you went there. December 16th, and we're finishing the Eishes Chayil chapter. Remember that this woman went through a metamorphosis. She starts off early on in the 12 psukim that go through the alphabet. Starts off that she's busy late at night, weaving garments for her children, and she's just sitting at the loom, and you know, these are things that a wealthy woman can do, but generally doesn't. You know, when you think of a woman making her clothes herself for her children, she's industrious, true, but she probably can't afford to go to the local Walmart, you know, and get even. You know, however it is, you always consider a woman who's making the kids, like probably about 6 or 7 kids, and they're all wearing the same diagram. You know, I don't know if you can picture it, but Amaisa, that's something that you consider a poor person doing. She wakes up very early to make sure their family has food, right? But then afterwards, you see the same woman is surveying land, right? And she's busy with Marvadim, which is this week's parsha. That's what Paro gives Yosef to wear, right? So it's not a common word in the Tanakh, and it's the clothing of royalty. This woman, early in her life, was making clothes for her children, and now, and the idea is that the metamorphosis that took place in the family, from the children wearing clothes woven late at night to wearing marvadim, is because of her industriousness, right? Get that sense? She's the one who made the family to go through this difference. And then, she's working on foundations. She's busy taking care of people even outside of her home. Right? Okay. So, right, so the she's wearing the garments of royalty, sheish v'argaman. These are only terminologies that are used in Tanakh with royalty. You only wore this kind of threads woven 6 times with purple and crimson. You only had that for you couldn't wear that if you're a commoner. So she is. And this leads to the fame of especially her husband, Nodav Asharim Bala, Mshiftovim Ziknei Oretz. And not so much because of who he is, but because of who he's married to. Right? So that is it's going a long way for him. Now, this is, assuming this is now getting back to our Mashal and Nimshal, that this is talking about the grandeur of Torah. So, Rabos Bono Sasuchayel Ba'atalis Al Kulano. You saw the Nitziv last week, remember? That he admitted that there's plenty of chayil to be made in outside Chochmah. Right? Of course, there's great Chochmah out there. But Ba'atalis Al Kulano, explain to me why. It's actually a question on the test. What is it about the Chochmah of Torah that is enhanced over all those other Chochmahs? Remember in Perek Beis, Pasuk Hey?
Did we speak about this earlier?
Yeah, okay. So, because all those other Chochmahs are morally neutral. The Torah, the dimension that the Torah is, and I think this is a great challenge. Tell me your experience. You were in fourth grade a lot more recently than I was. But my sense is that even in early grades and certainly in high school, that depending on the type of school you're going to, I find it debilitating that the schools that give you a top-notch Torah environment, where in fifth grade you're already learning Tosfos, and then in sixth grade you're already learning Shakis Aryeh, and in seventh grade you're doing Ketosis. In the schools where they really, really, that the kids are doing great Torah, it comes at the expense of secular studies. Right? The secular studies in such a school is not really up to par. And parents have to make a decision. Right? And I say that Nebuch, I find the opposite is also often true. Is that the schools that have a top-notch secular department, all right, their Torah is just a course, you know, 40 minutes here in the morning, then you're learning biology, and then chemistry, and then physics, and then we'll have a class in Diktuk at 1 o'clock, and a class in Chumash at 3 o'clock, and maybe at the end of the day, a little Gemara. Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong, it's just that my experience running around and writing curriculum and things like that is that one comes at the expense of the other. And why does it have to be that way?
Right? Because you only have a certain amount of time in the day.
Yeah, I know. And resources, not to mention resources. You want to go out there and get the best physics teacher that they could possibly find for your juniors and seniors in the high school. And that guy costs a lot of money. Right? Right, maybe the Torah teacher is more idealistic. Right? All right, anyway, the question is, can we challenge, mentally challenge in the Jewish studies the same way we're challenging the students I took calculus in 11th grade here at MTA, right? And I don't want to, you know, Chas v'Shalom say anything, you know, one way or another. Nebuch, that calculus teacher just passed away a few weeks ago, young guy. And my Rebbe that year passed away I'm already a dinosaur. My rebellion would be 100 years old today. But I'm just know we were challenged. It appears to me we were challenged more in the Mulei Chol. Why? Why does it have to be that? Okay. So my challenge to you is now you're well deep into your studies. I think that you. You would never miss a course of in your let's say your core course of your major because you have to study for a Mishlei test. I don't think so. But guys are missing a Mishlei class because they have an accounting final.
Maybe
you know what I'm saying?
That's major.
Okay, all right. So I would say it could be that your accounting test is more important than your Mishlei test. But your Mishlei class is more important than your accounting class. Because here you're learning Ba'atalis al Kulana. I mean, look, everything is taught, everything is relative. Right? But it could be that after you leave this place, right? Okay, whatever your degree is, accounting, biology, whatever you're going to go into, it's very, very likely that your accounting degree is going to have you working in accounting 9, 10, 11 hours a day. Certainly at the beginning, we have to really push, right? Especially around the March, April time. You're going to be working 12 hours a day in accounting, right? Even if you are doing what's called Koveya Itim LaTorah, you go to Minyan, you attend the Daf, you have a Shir 2-3 times a week, right? You learn Chumash and Rashi with your kid, right? At best, how many hours a day are you going to be learning? You get my point here? Right? When you leave this place, and this is Yeshiva University, right? You've been being trained to do something in the afternoon that you're going to be doing, you're a surgeon, you're going to be doing these things, you know, many hours a day. Alright, the point I'm trying to make for you, which is I've said in drushes in my shul to people older than you, is that your Torah that you're learning, right, is something that's supposed to be suffused through those 11 hours in accounting. I'm not saying you can make a Birchas HaTorah on an accounting book, but the morality of your Torah is supposed to guide you. And again, I don't think it's going to be made every single day. But there will be questions that you ask in surgery or whatever it is that should have Torah guidelines. Right? Okay, listen to this question I just got a few days ago. This woman works in an emergency room. works in an emergency room where her job is to deal with children who die in the emergency room. Got this? So she's asking me about what guidelines, what are the halachic guidelines that I have to take into the emergency room. Right? It's not an easy job to have, right? Okay, but she works in the emergency room. That's what they assigned to her. And I'm not saying she's going to be doing that forever, but that's what she's doing now. Right? So she's asking, what does the halacha have to say about what to do in these circumstances? Right? Remember, we mentioned, wrote down guidelines that she's giving, that she now, she's considered the moral arbiter of the emergency room for this particular thing, because she actually came up with guidelines. It's a big kiddush Hashem.
What's the difference between, I guess?
So there might be some differences between I'm sure the hospital has guidelines. Hospitals now have these, what do they call them? And the law firms have them. Like a mashgiach ruchani, like we have here in the yeshiva.
Yeah.
Why does yeshiva need a mashgiach ruchani? Isn't the yeshiva a place suffused with morality? We're learning Torah, right? Why do we need a mashgiach ruchani? So it's interesting that the concept started with the Muslim movement of having a mashgiach ruchani in the yeshiva. I mean, everything we're doing is mashgiach ruchani, no? Maybe not. Rav Chaim Eliezer was quoted as saying that a yeshiva without a mashgiach ruchani is like a bor b'rishus harabim. Can you explain that?
Well,
it's a bor b'rishus harabim. It's a pit waiting for people to fall into. It's broken glass on the floor. And you're walking barefoot. Why? I think it's true about a law firm also. And I think it's very true about a hospital. I'm constantly dealing with four doctors and two children and maybe a wife talking about being pressured to take the guy finally get him off the machine. He's old, he's too old already. And let him just die a peaceful death. Very often.
Doesn't that
depends. Is this guy 87 years old and on fourth stage cancer and he's hemorrhaging in the brain? Or is this a man who was healthy until now and you know he had a stroke and depends on the situation.
So they're
being pressured now, especially with Obamacare. I got to tell you, and the architect of Obamacare is saying that any person over 75 who takes medications and procedures is cheating the system. Did you read that? Appeared. Yeah. He wrote it. It wasn't nothing. He's quoted. It's his words. Ezekiel Emanuel. Rahm Emanuel's brother. Right? 75. That's crazy. He says he's 57 now. He says, when I'm getting to be 75, I will not take, quote me, I will not take medications. I'll be healthy. I'm working my health, so I never have to take a medication.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
All right, okay. We'll see. I mean, his words, But that's what he's saying. So why? Because at 77 you're no longer productive? My father worked till he was 80. And because what? So what does that mean then? With the 37-year-olds who are not productive, what are we going to do with them? Are we slippery, sloping to Nazi Germany now with euthanasia programs? Of course they're going to say no, but still. He came right out with it. And when Sarah Palin said that this is what they're going to do, they're going to tell old people you can't take medications, she was excoriated. Everyone from James, from what's his name? John Stewart? To the serious commentators with raking her over the coals for saying that. But that's exactly what the architects are saying. A hospital needs a mashgiach ruchani. And the arbiters now are constantly pressuring you. We need this machine for someone younger. Get this guy off. There are limited resources. All right, I know. Okay, you have to triage. So they need someone, a moral arbiter, not just someone who has the hospital's interests at stake, and a law firm definitely needs this, an accounting firm definitely needs this. Right? Why does the yeshiva need it? Reb Chaim said more than anybody. And I think that it's very instructive. Something about Kain and Hevel. What is it about Kain and Hevel that proves that the yeshiva needs a mashgiach ruchani even more than a law firm?
Because competition for good cause. Can you tell me?
Right. What was their competition about?
Sacrificing to Hashem.
Getting God's favor, for goodness sakes. You don't think they had sibling rivalry before then? I mean, these are two brothers. What do you expect? Right? Especially when the older one seems to be outflanked by the younger one, as we learn. So when apparently things went okay with all the other sibling rivalries that they had, when did it get violent? When they started bringing korbanos, maybe you know the mission at the beginning of the second parak in Maseches Yuma. It says that had they determined which kohanim got to do the early work in the Beis Hamikdash. Should you hear this? It's amazing. If you never heard this, you're going to laugh. It was a race. They lined up the kohanim in a certain place, and they had a race. The first kohen to get up the ramp, he did.
Didn't people push other people?
Yes. So the first time, someone pushed someone off the ramp and he broke his leg. The next time, someone stabbed the guy and killed him.
This was the first time he'd been established?
No, this isn't the time it's by the Shemi.
And then the Gemara adds a horrific critique is that the Kohanim, who saw that man stabbed, they were more concerned that he might be dead because of Tumah and spreading Tumah around them and inconveniencing them to all the mikvah. Possibly have ashes poured on them than they were about such a horrific death while trying to do something to God. Because whatever motivates us to justify what we're doing, there is no motivation like religion. Hello, what's going on in the world today, for goodness sakes? You can have all the pundits in the world saying, that's not Islam. That's not true Islam. Really? It is a state, and it's very Islam.
So let's say somebody says that Judaism, stoning people to death, the whole city should, or things like that. Right?
So here's what I was saying. You can't take the biblical text out of context and apply it to the 21st century. And you can't take it without the oral tradition defining it.
But the oral tradition doesn't say that we're going to
tradition don't says that stoning hardly ever happened.
Right? Stoning people?
Stoning people? It was 1 in 100 years.
Okay, but it's all right, it happened. But you have to take it into context. The one that everyone picks on is, what are you stoning this 12-year-old kid, this little boy who disobeys his parents?
That never happened. So, okay, there's the oral traditions that never happened, but even in the context of it happening, it's way ahead of the milieu of this time. Because in ancient Near East, if your son gave discipline problems at home, he was your property. You killed him at home. The Torah's chiddush is, you have to take him to the shower here, to the court, and then they'll sort it out. To the point where the Gemara says that the requirements to make it happen are so remote that it never can happen, it never did happen.
So I must allow the Muslims also to have an oral tradition. They have also scholars in what does the Quran mean, and they have their interpretations, etc. But they're acting those things out. They're beheading children and putting their heads on stakes to frighten others. So those are things that are going on. And their leaders are saying that's okay. And the leaders are
drawing them to do so. You have others on there that say Shiites, Sunnis.
I don't want to get lost in this. But the point is that Torah, says Rav Chaim Weizer, can be dangerous also in the hands of a fanatic. Right? Okay. So he was also quoted as saying, don't make an avodah zarah out of the halacha. Can you get the brilliance of such a statement? Don't make an avodah zarah out of the halacha. Because the deity is God. Right?
The pasuk in Tehillim, it's very instructive. It sounds like a pasuk in Mishlei. Eis la sos la shem hei feiru torasecha.
When it's a time to do something for God, that's what made Eliyahu or for Kabbalahs up in the north, contravening the Torah law, and why we were allowed to go out Nefesh to go for Shabbos. And it's a time to do for God. So obviously, with that in mind, what's obviously the only law that you're not allowed to violate with that in mind? Everything else has more components of Avodah Zarah, because it's God. Worshiping Avodah Zarah is meaning it's God. You can't say Eis La'asot Hashem, I'm going to work out worship Avodah Zarah. Eis La'asot Hashem, anything's on the table, but not Avodah Zarah.
So the other two things are wrong.
No. It's something called Uras Shah. Uras Shah means for this moment, Eliyahu says this is what we have to do. Eliyahu tells you, go sleep with that married woman. You should do it.
Also murder as well.
Yeah, story like that in the Sefer Malachim. So I like that you say murder. Killing, yeah, you kill at war. Right? You don't murder at war. You don't murder a murderer. You kill a murderer. But further to Zelot HaRoh, because it's a little bit tough. Okay, but never I will deserve. Anyway, the issue in hand is that the Torah adds a dimension of morality, but be very careful. People have done many immoral things in the name of Torah. Right? I think historically we're a little less guilty of that than some other religions. Right? Did you say? No, two of these. Okay. Alright. So the reason why I'm going in this direction, remember the Rokeach, what he said in Perek Beis, that we have to be steeped in certain other limudim. Right? He said, Chila Mikra, first learn Tanakh, Chakach Mishnah, the Talmud, and learn Mishnah and Talmud, like it says in Perek Avos. Chakach Chochmas HaTeva. Now, what would you say that includes? Chochmas HaTeva. Yeah, it's a lot, but that can include a whole bunch of things, no? Okay. Right? But that's the direct translation. Natural science, does that include biology? You know, does that include direct science? It's not, no, it includes all kinds of things. Right? And maybe even physics and chemistry. There's all kinds of things to be included. V'chakach chochmas kochavim u'mazolus. He did not consider chochmas ha-teva, because chochmas ha-kochavim u'mazolus seems to move in the direction of Lamala and Teva. If it's physics, it's metaphysics. Right? Rambam has an amazing halacha in Chos Yisodei HaTorah. He says that all heavenly objects have consciousness. It sounds a little hokey, doesn't it? That all the comets and the planets, anything that's in the heavens, because it says, Hashamayim v'safrim k'vod ke'el, the stars sing out God's praises, right? Tilchus Yisodei HaTorah, Perek Gimel, Halacha Tes, and he says that they actually do. And he goes at the end of the halacha, he says, and they are lower than angels in consciousness, but higher than humans. Really, Ron? When did I say this? I saw it in the Alchemy on the way. He says that when Yosef dreams about the 11 stars and the sun and the moon bowing to him, right? He was very intent on making it so that dream would come true. It's crucial for him for these dreams to come true because he saw them as prophetic. And he wants to make the prophecy come true. To the extent it seems that Ramban says he tried so hard to make it come true that he lost the actual Malchus to the one who confronted him. Right? For the abuse of power. Right? The Torah, this Shabbos, if it's not Hanukkah, which only happens every 25 years or so, is the story of Shlomo being ready to cut a baby in half in front of a crowd to determine the true mother. Right? So what's the connection? What's the connection with Mikates and Shlomo cutting a baby in half? So the connection is a medrash that says that when Shlomo expressed
the command to cut a baby in half, and people thought, oh, they can't see what the king says. Let's take out the sword and cut it in half. And he had a whole room gasping, thinking that he really meant to do that. So a heavenly voice came out and said, okay, so quick to cut the baby in half, cut his kingdom in half. Cut the kingdom in half.
He wasn't going to actually do it. That was part of his plan.
So what's that do with Yosef? It was an abuse of power. By the way, I want to tell you something. There are many, many, more than 20 ancient stories about a very wise man trying to determine the true owner of something by, he's obviously in power to make it happen, by deciding to cut it in half to see the reaction of the people. Right? What is that? I don't want to spell any of your ideas about the veracity of the story. But the point of the story is, it appears in the logic, is that our approach to this story is that, and this is why it's important to have like an oral tradition for things, is that that was not a good thing to do. And all these other stories, that, wow, what a wise king, he's so perfect, he's so wonderful. Our reaction to this story is that this is not wise, maybe wise, but it wasn't moral. And for that he lost his kingdom, right? The next generation, split in half, you get it? Cut the kingdom in half. It's ironic because there's another Maimon Chazal that says the same thing about David HaMelech. If you know your Shmuel Beis, David HaMelech accepted Lashon Hara from Tziva about Mephibosheth, and he said, okay Tziva, split the field with him, cut it in half. And there too, a heavenly voice, right there, it's actually in this Gemara about the two Kohanim and Ron Racing. It's a commentary on that Gemara, it's the beginning of the second Parak Yuma. It says that because of that impetuous psak, that the heavenly voice came out and said, your kingdom will be split in half.
Right. It wasn't his kingdom, it was just
because it may have been a very wise story, and it's appreciated for its wisdom in the ancient world, but it's not a moral story, because it's not moral to make people in the room think you're going to cut a human being in half. No matter what your ultimate intention is.
So suggesting that Shlomo should arrive at that judgment a different way?
Maybe. Careful how you. He knew who the real mother was. We just want to, you know, convince everybody around.
Why do you think that?
So there are indications within the story. You have to be medactic, but I'm not gonna go there right now. But there are indications about the way the women talk. I've never met anyone who could recreate that story exactly as it appears in the Bible. Everyone gets it wrong.
What do you recreate?
What?
What do you mean by recreate?
You want to try? Go ahead. Tell what happened. Two women come into court and say, this is my baby, that one says it's my baby. What happened?
I don't know
what
the details. They claimed a lot of stuff.
Remember anything?
Oh, one thing.
That's the first thing, the two zonos. That's the first pasuk calls in zonos. And here, the Targum and Rav Rashi doesn't try to hide that. They're not innkeepers, like Zabrachov. They're prostitutes. So start off with one thing. Prostitutes generally don't like to have babies around.
Who's
business? What?
Rachel was also
a girl. I know, but they have Targum and Rashi say something else. Anyway, you have to do what else?
One baby dies and one remains alive. The mother of the baby that dies takes away the baby that is alive and claims it as hers.
Okay, good.
And the mother that actually gave birth to the live baby wakes up in the morning and realizes her baby's dead.
She's the plaintiff, yeah, go ahead.
And that, that live
so
baby...
So here's the case. Go ahead, what happens?
Now there's a middle detail before he decides to make that judgment of splitting them in half. Okay,
he says, cut the baby in half, come on out.
The mother of the dead baby says yes, and the mother of the actual baby says I'd rather around the baby than the baby die.
Everybody in this class agree with that?
No.
Tell me why.
Because you said that you never heard anyone do it.
You are wrong. Anybody else like to correct him?
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, that's it. Am I correct?
They both agree to cut the baby in half at first.
It's crazy. The order is the opposite. In the Tanakh, first the mother said, the real mother said, don't cut him in half. Cut him in half. That's the king's law. She didn't want the baby. She doesn't want the baby. She might have even rolled over him on purpose. She just doesn't want to be seen as a baby killer or something like that. Right? Now, if she doesn't want the baby, why did she take the other baby? Just be happy with that. Well, maybe she had to shed some kind of thing to do afterwards. But she says, no, that's the king's tzak. Let's kill this baby and we won't have no baby. She could just be vindictive. There could be many reasons why she's holding this. But the order, the reason why everyone gets it wrong is because the order in the Tanakh is inexplicably the opposite. Wait a second. Why did you come to court with this woman today? If you're happy with the baby cut in half. Obviously you came to court as a defendant because you have your position. You want the baby. Right? So that's the problem with the story. I once heard an offshoot of this about two families who both paid a premium to a shotgun, $10,000, for getting the best boy in the yeshiva to marry their daughter. But both of them paid $10,000. How can they? And then the shotgun split. She was a fake and a phony, but she's up $20,000. She went to another place halfway around the world. No one knows where she is. So these two families have both want the boy for their daughter. Now I paid $10,000. Why should that family get the boy? Right? And each one says, I paid the $10,000. It's mine. So they took it to the Torah. And the rabbi said, okay, see, it says, Choshen Mishpul, two people have equal claim to the same thing. What do you do?
Cut it in half.
Cut the boy in half. Cut it right down the middle. Give half. I'm sorry, but that's what you have to do, because it's only each one have the exact claim. Give half the boy to him for her daughter, half the boy for her daughter, and then let them be happy.
Do you cut him at the waist or down the middle?
No, down the middle. So he thinks they have the same thing. Right? So one mother said, no, that's crazy psak. I can't party to such a psak. I'm going to do the boy and let the key. It just doesn't sound right to me. Forget it. I'm not going to go along with this. The second woman said, no. That's the psak. Cut the boy right in half. Half for her daughter, half for me, for my daughter, and that's it. So the rabbi looked at the second woman and said, give the boy to her for her daughter. She's the true mother-in-law.
Wait, so what happened to you?
I think they didn't play the boy in half. Okay, so anyway,
there's a knot in the text.
What?
It's not Pshat, it's necessarily that there's a knot in the text.
What are you looking at? Do you remember Malachim?
I'm looking at Malachim.
Yeah?
Because the one saying the sheep and not, and I'm looking at the arsenal, they're referencing Yeshua Perfet.
Yeah, that's the same thing with Rachel.
It's on the same thing.
It's
on
the same thing. It's on the same thing.
What do you think those innkeepers did? We can make implications, but it's not explicit.
Okay. I it's funny because usually a lot of them are forced to do that with Rachel because they like Rachel. But these two women, it's clear what they're doing. Alright.
How would you explain it? One of them actually
gives
left
the
baby.
But
she left
the
baby.
No,
no.
The one who's...
Why does that matter?
If there's
nothing so
terrible. So why did she come to court? One of them... You made the point that the Zohar don't want the baby.
She just doesn't... I mean, she just doesn't want to be seen in a large public forum as someone who rolled over and killed her baby, because that might ruin my business. But I'll leave this court with the baby, and I'll work it out, you know, privately afterwards. But she had the baby in her hand. She could have had him. Right? You get it? Why I'm not telling you this whole story is because the moral component of the story is considered lacking in Chazal. This is not, it may be a story of wisdom, but it's not a story of morality. I take you also to the Haggadah. Haggadah has four sons, right? Can you divide them evenly? How were they divided, apparently?
Always.
Well, three of them seem to be divided by
intellect. Chacham. Shenede v'shol. The top. Especially according to Yushami, he calls the top tibesh. Right? And only one by morality. Russia is a moral description. Russia may be smarter than the Chacham. Right? We're not talking about how wise he is. There are plenty of very evil people who have been wise. Right? We should use that terminology. I think in English, wise has, doesn't wise have a connotation?
That's goodness.
Goodness also?
Smartness. Well, that's the evil is the word.
Intelligent.
Intelligent, right? Okay, so wise. I think wise in let's say, in age also. So, okay. Okay, anyway, so sagacious maybe. So, but Chazal looked at this story and said, this may be smart, but it's not moral. Okay, so okay, so Yosef, that's the connection between Miketz and the Haftorah, and that's gonna be this week is Hanukkah. But that's the connection between the case and this story. Is that both Yosef and Shlomo are abusing their position to the point where it has a nefarious and deleterious result. Now, in the case of Yosef, it's so obvious. Shouldn't it be obvious to Yaakov that Yosef should be the one who rules over all of them? He is ruling over them now, right? They're bowing down to him. He can have his way with them. So, well, surely he should be supposed to be his descendant, should be a king, don't you think? Right? So, why not? So the answer is because he went too far. He abused himself. If he wanted to see that the boys were rehabilitated, he knows that already. He listens to the conversation. Right? So, okay, I understand the Bravo now says he wants to put them into the exact same position of leaving a favorite son of Yaakov behind, right, and going home and telling them about it. Right? Will you do that, or are you going to put up a fight? And this time it's like a kalachomer. I mean, this time, you know, Dad, I can't believe this. I told you I would bring Binyamin home. You wouldn't believe what happened. He stole the viceroy's cup. I don't think the brothers believed he sold it. They realized that it was crazy. All the money was there again. And they knew something phony was going on. But the facts are still there. Right? So Yosef could... It's not just the brothers. It's 9 years that he's in power, for goodness sakes. You know, why did he hold out so much longer to his father? And it's amazing, during that whole time, none of the brothers broke down and told their father, Dad, you know, I have to tell you, Yosef may be alive. What? What happened that day? He was dead. But then he would have broken the silence for years. There was a code of omerta for all these guys, right? They took a chaver not to breathe a word of this. All those years. Right? One has to wonder, did Yosef ever tell his father exactly how he became to be in such a position? So Yosef has some tshuva to do also. Because he abused his position as a child. Right? If the brothers felt that he wanted to make it Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, and you fall away, just like all of Avram's other children fell away, right? That's maybe why they took such a harsh reaction to him, right? So, Yosef, I've seen some of Arshim say that Yosef could have had it that way. Imagine if he had embellished on what the brothers did to him, to his father. Right? He told him, you know, remember that day, Dad, when you sent me to find them? Let me tell you what happened that day. They threw me in the pit, and they said, and I begged them, please, don't kill me. You know, what did it mean to fight? I promise I'll never wear the shirt. You can take the shirt. Take it. Each of you, any one of you can have it. You can rip it apart if you want. I'm never going to tell any dreams. I'm never going to bring bad reports again. Just bring me back to Father. I'll be on my best behavior. And they spit on me and they said, we want to see our father suffer. We can't wait to see what his reaction is when we show him your coat drenched in blood. And he could have made up anything he wanted. Yaakov would have believed it. Right? And then Yaakov would have, look what he did to Reuven and Shimon and Levi for what they had done years and years earlier. Right? What would they have done if he had gone one by one and said, this is what God did, this is what Usher did, this is what... Right? So he has his own children to do. He has them. He could do whatever he wanted. And he realizes, no, I went too far with them when I was younger, when I was immature, and now he's doing his own children. Right? Because I'll say that Yaakov didn't recognize his grandsons, not because they were dressed like Egyptians. Not because he was blind, but because Yosef never took them to him. Yosef avoided him all those years. Because every time Yaakov sat him down, he said, tell me, Yosef, what happened that day? Yaakov was aware that the brothers hated him. In the bracha of Yosef, it seems that Yaakov was aware that he was hated, but he came out on top in the end. All right, so this is my answer, is that the connection between Miketz and the story of Shlomo is this abuse of power. Okay? All right, so then he says, V'achar kach chochma she'ita zochel l'nevuah. Afterwards, this chochma from which you can reach nevuah. Chochma that drives you to nevuah. Okay. All right. So the end says, "Rabbos banos asukhaya batilis alkunav." There's a lot of chokhmah out there, but you have a dimension. So you see, notice what I've been avoiding. I've been avoiding saying that your chokhmah is a higher level than theirs. Is it true that a ktsos, the chokhmah you need to get through the entire ktsos, which was written by someone when he was very young, he was like a teenager when he wrote it, I think, the young 20s, to get through the whole Shev Shmaitza, and to get through the whole Shad Zaryan and Chaskinuch, that you have to be in a higher intellectual plane than to understand quantum physics or Einstein's theories, or, you know what I'm saying? Put Einstein and the Vilna Gaon together and then have a match over intellect. Who's coming out on top? You know, I don't really care. I don't care. That's my concern. Not my concern here. The concern is the morality aspect, and that's the difference. All right? Quantum physics doesn't offer morality. Okay. Now, is it possible to be fully steeped in Torah and yet not be a good husband? Right? The abusive of others when you speak, that's a real problem. That's a big chilul Hashem, perhaps. But then you can say, alright, that person did not learn the Torah. That person forgot this and this and this. That's what the Muslim movement tried to promulgate. Okay, you get it? The Muslim movement tried to say, listen, if the Torah is not refining you, so you learning a book this semester, which is the book of Tanakh, that makes that point more than any other. Right? Yeah, sure, Yeshayahu wants people to be morally upright, no question. As does Yeshayahu, Amos, and Hosea. But Mishlei, at its core, is here to assure that, and it's the first great book of Musar that has survived in its fullness like this. To be sure, also, I've given you some Egyptian proverbs, right? You've seen those, right? Where there are numerous ones that can be bent into shape to teach the same thing as a lot of us look in the Mishnah. And those Egyptian proverbs are older, a lot of them, right? All right, what's the big deal? If something is true, right? If something is true about an industry and jealousy and about the positive nature of thriftiness, and if it's true, it'll produce there are general points that can be true about any society about positive, what we consider positive character traits. But what emerges from Mishlei that does not emerge from any of these ancient sources is what I keep telling you over and over again is this aspect of morality. yes, there's something. I'm not saying that that the other good nations try to be immoral. No, I'm not going to go there. But there may be a difference in a notion of morality from 3,000 years ago, where polygamy is allowed, where slavery is allowed, tolerated and allowed, where stoning is common. I mean, what would you do if we started giving Malchus 39 lashes we don't cut off hands for Gezel, but we sell them to slavery for Gezel. Right? I do it for Malchus for eating a cheeseburger or eating bacon or shaving with a razor. Right? Do any other law. I'm just looking at Malchus in Israel now. What is it that we're hoping for? A return. I have to be satisfied with some portion that say, well, we're not going back to a second commonwealth. We're going back to a situation where this might be tweaking the Sefer Machos a little bit, where the Zachari refers to as like a Shechitas Yetzer Hara, where it'll be impossible to give Machos. Not just because no one's sinning. No, I think there will always be Jews eating bacon, but because the burdens placed upon actually giving it, many of these punishments are like what the Gemara does with Bitzorah Mora. I mean, let's be frank with ourselves. To go back to that kind of society is the country of the world that we most would come up is Iran, right? No. Okay, so get back to our point is that the proverb of this book has the morality at hand, and please always keep this chuveret with the Sefer Mishlei. Made into simple, acceptable, easily understood proverbs for our own use. Okay, so we're going to see. We end up, however, with Sheker Achim Behevel Ayofi Isha Yiras Hashem Yitzalal. So we love you, Priyodel Yavu B'Shar Maaseh. So the end is just a recap. Think of where this woman's actions have taken her. It's taken her from poverty, where she has to weave clothes late at night for her children, to buying real estate and surveying and making Maravadim and Arbaman, Sheish Arbaman, and the royal clothing, and then the family becomes very well known because of her, what she's done for them. Is that, if you want to talk, what did the Jewish people do for the world? We gave the polio vaccine. I don't think Jonas Salk did it as a Jew. He did it as a researcher, right? I'm saying, but Jews. I've heard anthropologists say because especially Jews who study Hebrew have to do something when they're 2-3 years old that really maybe only the Chinese have to do in order to read the language. Because there are no vowels, the vowels have to be read independently of the letter. So, especially when you're trained to read even without vowels, so much that a three-year-old has to do with Hebrew that is... Now, in one way, Hebrew is actually a little... Something about Hebrew makes it easier than other languages because of its antiquity. It's the only two languages on the planet that have shared this. The other one is Spanish. Is that it is fully phonetic. Right, you know what I'm saying? Like in English, L-A-U-G-H is not phonetic because it comes from a German word, Lachter, so they put a G-H in there. Any Hebrew English word that has a G-H, like light, daughter, because it taken from another language, Tochter, Licht, so they put in the extra letter from it. But Hebrew doesn't have that. Hebrew is fully phonetic. A cook with an E under it is always K. Right?
But because from our earliest days, we have to think twice. It's like playing piano. You have to think with your left side and right side. And from 4, 5, 6, 7, there we are trained already by just reading the language to be thinking on the higher cognitive levels.
I've been on the beginning of the semester.
And therefore, and we are morally attuned to make more of a difference. Right? The Jews are such a tiny percentage of the population and have made such a greater effect. And that's what we mean by Tnula mi priyadeha mi halua b'ashar ma'asel. Now, of course, like Yosef with his brothers, I don't think we've called upon that enmity. Sometimes we have in history. We made foolish decisions or foolish Jews did foolish things. But they hate us. Because of our accomplishments, because we think we're chosen, whatever the reason is, but our ma'asim have greatly enhanced the world. Right? The world is wearing royalty, and then Sheish Vargamon, and all the other things we've accomplished in our small numbers. The problem. So here is what an advice. I would like to leave you with advice. Why? What's this sheker achim behevel ayofi? Sheker achim. What's the advice of this? Because it seems that the great women of the Bible are all called chen and yofi. Nice of all those avos to marry babes, huh? Sarah's gorgeous. Rivka, everyone has her eye. Rachel is your fast Torah, right? Every great woman is called beautiful. So why are you telling me sheker achim behevel ayofi? So here is advice that I leave you, and this is crucial, is that we have given great ma'asim to the world based on our gift of morality in the Bible. But if we lose sight of that morality and instead pursue chen and yofi, you know what I mean by that, right? And we pursue big mansions and the like, right? We pursue too much chen and too much yofi, then that will make them jealous. How can the Jews are doing so well? Who this happened? Lech me'imanu ki yotzamtem mimenu ma'od. Remember the Plishtim told Yitzchak? Get out of here! You're becoming greater than us! You don't even worship our gods! How can you be in our midst, don't worship our gods, and you're ki yotzamtem mimenu ma'od? I say we move to our neighborhoods. 40 years ago, there were no Jews in Teaneck. Right? We moved to neighborhoods, to five towns, in Teaneck, and Great Neck, and what we in Muncie, as I see it all over now, Muncie, is no one even lives in the house that was there 15, 20 years ago. They have to buy two lots, knock down the houses. It takes about a year to knock them down because you can't just dynamite them. You have to hit them with hammers and then pull out the nails and knock down the house. And the neighbors are watching you do this. Over a period of 2-3 years, and what comes in its place? A monstrosity with 24 bedrooms. I see it in Deal, I see it wherever I go, where Jews live. I see it in Flatbush, wherever Jews live. So, Sheker Achein, Ve'ol Ayofi. Look, I don't want to begrudge anybody from living in a great place. I happen to live in Manhattan where no one can see. If you want a double apartment, you just have to break down a wall between the two of them. No one. It's right there. Right? So you know, I don't begrudge, but when it's so vocal, so out there, it becomes like we have a summer oil of him. So then Shlomo is warning us, and who can warn us better than Shlomo? Right? Because he's the one in Shkohelis, Paraphase, remember we talked about that many times. That he tried all the magnificence, all the great enjoyments that the world has to offer. And he said that he didn't do anything. Let me try. Let me give it a shot. It says money can't buy you anything. Just one thing money can't buy.